Next case for argument, United States v. Fenzel. Mr. Campbell.
Good morning, Your Honor. Counsel, may it please the Court, my name is Terry Campbell. I represent Steve Fenzel, the appellant in this case. Your Honors, we have very unusual facts in this case for a criminal contract fraud prosecution. There is no dispute, there is no allegation, nor is there any evidence that the city, the only alleged victim here, paid an inflated price on the contract at issue. There is no allegation, nor is there any evidence, that the services weren't performed or performed well. Indeed, just the opposite. The government agreed wholeheartedly that the city got the lowest available price in the market pursuant to competitive bidding. There were, in that regard, at least three other bids that were wholly independent of anything that was alleged to be connected to the defendants. And so the government said on more than one occasion, this is not a case about whether the city of Chicago got a good price. If it were, we wouldn't be here. Those facts are hardly the earmarks of a federal criminal fraud. And now we start with a proposition that this court has recited on more than one occasion, and that is that the mail fraud statute does not make a federal crime out of every deceit. That is undeniably true. The government argues just the opposite. They say the mere fact that there was some deceit, and for purposes of this argument, we'll acknowledge that there was a deceit because it makes no difference to this argument. They say because Urban Services got a contract, it would not have received absent its false representations. That is fraud. And that, Your Honors, is not the law. It's not the law from the clear holding of the Supreme Court's McNally decision. In McNally, and in a host of other cases that we cited in our briefs, it is clear that the defendants received money. This case...
Yeah, but I think the government's strongest argument concerns these minority and women's business enterprises because the city, for whatever reasons, it wants to have these people get a share of the contract. And they thought they were getting that, but they were deceived. They weren't getting it. And so that means they're not getting the contract that they want. Right? Even if they don't have a pecuniary loss, there's a loss if a policy of providing contractual opportunities for these enterprises is thwarted by a deceit.
And I'll give you two answers to that question. Number one is McNally, because in McNally, it's exactly the same situation, and that is the state of Kentucky didn't want to contract with people who were insiders. They didn't want people who were insiders in the government to get this contract. They would not have given that contract to them had they known that they were insiders. And so you have the same type of harm, and that is it is not an economic harm. It is not a monetary harm. It's a regulatory harm, and that's part two of this.
The regulatory harm.
The regulatory issue is the city says we have a policy. We have a policy that it is good to foster minority and women business enterprises, and that's a fine policy, but that is a regulatory issue, and it is not an issue of money or property. So one thing which has struck me is the government has never
well,
distinguished
an issue
McNally.
Of money and property for these for the minority and women's business enterprises, they get less money.
But they are not the alleged victims of this fraud. Only the city is. And so what you have to have is an alleged harm of an economic or monetary nature to the alleged victim here.
Actually, that's not a requirement of the criminal offense. That's a requirement of civil fraud, but it's not a requirement of criminal fraud, victim loss.
Well, you don't have to have actual loss. There's no doubt about that. And so what we argued was that in order to show an intent to defraud, you have to have either actual or intended harm to the victim. You have to have some actual harm or
enrichment to yourself.
Well, enrichment to yourself is not enough. McNally makes that clear. There's no question
that's in the domain of intangible services fraud. We're in money or property fraud land here.
Well, actually, as I understand McNally, it was before 1346 existed, and so the intangible rights was considered. It was argued as that is money or property, and they said, no, that's not money or property. And the argument was, because these people got a contract that they would not have gotten otherwise, had the Commonwealth of Kentucky known the true facts that these people were insiders, they wouldn't have gotten that contract. And they said that is not money or property because even though the defendants got money, and they clearly did, and there's a raft of cases that we cite from this circuit and others that talk about exactly this principle, the fact that the defendant got money is not sufficient. There has to be. McNally's term, the key term is deprivation. You have to have gotten something for nothing. You have to have cheated them. It cannot be that
What did McNally get?
McNally, they sold insurance. They had some interest, I believe, in an insurance brokerage, and so they sold insurance to the Commonwealth of Kentucky that if the state had known that these insiders had an interest in this, they would not have contracted with them. And McNally says, hey, the fact that the Commonwealth wouldn't have done it had they known about this insider's interest without evidence that they paid a higher price than they would have otherwise, or that they bought something that they wouldn't have bought otherwise, you cannot satisfy the money or property requirement. That's what McNally says. So the mere fact that money changes hands is not the key. It's deprivation. It's cheating. That's fraud. And without a deprivation, either actual or intended, but one of them, you cannot have the intent to defraud. And we don't have that here, even by the admission of the government. They don't say that they paid more for the services. They don't say that they got services that the city wouldn't have otherwise gotten. In fact, they admit that they got the lowest possible price and that all the services were performed. The evidence is undisputed on those issues. To the extent that there was any doubt about McNally's holding, I think the dicta from the Skilling decision makes it clear, where they give a specific example of the type of conduct that would not satisfy a 1341 money and property fraud. They say in Skilling, look, if a city official gets a bribe, but the contract that is let is at the market price, and there's no evidence that the city or the municipality wouldn't have entered into a contract for those services or goods absent the bribe, there's no tangible harm. No tangible harm. And that's what is required here. That's money or property. And they say, of course, now that does fit under 1346, the bribe or the kickback. There's no tangible harm. It doesn't fit 1341. And what we're dealing with here is strictly a 1341 and 1343 case. So I think that the law is clear, and it is impossible to reconcile McNally with the notion and the evidence in this case where there was no harm by the admission of the government. No monetary harm. Zero. I'd like to turn next to the issue of Investigator Brown's testimony here. I respectfully submit that there is no question that at a minimum Mr. Fensel is entitled to a new trial based on Investigator Brown's testimony. Mr. Brown was allowed to testify to the meaning, the import, and specifically to the materiality and even the actual reliance of the city on the certification which is at issue, this boilerplate small print certification that's on page 88 of the bid document. There is no doubt The evidence is undisputed on this that Investigator Brown had no personal knowledge about those topics. Zero. He admitted as much during cross-examination.
But he knew what the purpose of the certification was.
I'm sorry?
He was competent to testify about the purpose of the certification.
I don't think he was. I mean, the certification is what it is. And what they put Mr. Brown on purportedly as was a lay witness. And he was offering an opinion about what the certification meant. There was no reason to have lay opinion testimony about the meaning of the certification. That was plain from the language of it. And so what they really did was try to sneak in expert testimony. So someone who comes in under the guise of law enforcement, someone who has been involved in fraud investigations for 7 years and has that experience, here's what this really means. And not only did he say, here's what the certification means, but he said, the government makes a big point in their brief, hey, we don't have to show actual reliance. That's right. They don't have to show actual reliance. But what did they have their witness testify to? He testified that the city actually did rely on this. And he had zero personal knowledge of that. Zero personal knowledge of that. So the harm was exacerbated. It would have been one thing had they stopped when the district court judge told them, stop, don't do this anymore. On the night that he first began offering improper opinion testimony, we had a lengthy colloquy with the judge, and the government represented to the district court, no, we're not going to go any farther. We're not going to ask him his opinion on these things. He's only going to read documents. The next morning, they ask him, if the city had known this, would they have let this contract to Urban? There's an objection. And he says no. So while they could have put in the certification, and they could have argued from the certification, hey, there is a reasonable possibility that someone would rely on this.
They was could have there done any voir dire or equivalent to ask him how he would know what the city would do?
There was not voir dire because, I guess for two reasons. One is he was not proffered as an expert witness.
I understand that. I'm using the term loosely. I mean, was there an inquiry of him as to how he would know what the city would do?
The answer is the inquiry on cross-examination, he admitted, one, he was, quote, not involved in any respect in the handling of this bid for the refurb contract. Two, he was not involved in any discussions whatsoever with anybody in the procurement department, which handles all contracts for the city. He was not involved in any discussions whatsoever with anyone in procurement about this bid at the time it was being considered, and that he doesn't know. He admitted this. Doesn't know if procurement would or would not have considered Urban's bid if they'd known that Mr. Ritter, not Mr. Fenzel, but Mr. Ritter, let's remember, who was the actor here, if they'd
so
known that he was
what
involved.
What exactly is Brown's background?
The only thing I know about his background is that the testimony was he has worked at the Inspector General's office as an investigator for 7 years.
Wasn't there a discussion with the judge and counsel about the scope of his testimony at some point along the way?
Absolutely, and this is what I referenced earlier. His testimony was broken into 2 days. And so his direct started in the afternoon, and he had offered a couple of what we believed were inappropriate opinions about things. And at the end of the day, we had objected on a couple of occasions. At the end of the day, we had a lengthy colloquy with the judge where we said, hey, this is inappropriate. He can't offer his personal opinions. He doesn't have any basis for them on these issues. So he can talk about what a document says, but he can't say here's the meaning or here's what this meant to the city or here's what the intent of the defendants was. And the judge said, government, stop it. And the government said, judge, we have no intent of doing that anymore. And yet that's exactly what they did the next morning.
Right. So when the objection was made to the end game reliance question, did the judge just forget his ruling from the night before, or what happened?
You know, I think the easiest answer to that is trials are fluid. We made an objection. I think it was clearly well-founded in light of what the judge had said the night before. And the judge made an on-the-spot ruling, and I think it was a mistake. And it was a critical mistake. And how do we know it was critical? We know it was critical because that specific question and answer was cited at least 3 times by the government in its closing argument. And this wasn't, you know, a 2-hour closing argument, but they kept saying, Brown told you. Brown told you the city relied on this. So the notion that we don't have to prove actual reliance and therefore defendant's argument is all wet gets them nowhere because they did that.
Well, it goes to materiality. I assume that that's why the argument was made that way.
Well, that's absolutely right. It goes to materiality. So they put it on in a way that was unassailable, unchallengeable, because now it comes from someone who purportedly has this knowledge from his 7 years of experience, and he doesn't say, yeah, it's likely or it's possible that they relied on it, which I don't even think he should have been allowed to do. That's argument, not evidence. But he says, no, I know for a fact the city actually did. And that wasn't a mistake that testimony came out. That was the question from the prosecutor after the judge had told them, don't do it.
How is this line of questioning harmful in light of the alternate grounds for the fraud here, the non-certification grounds?
Well, I think the answer is a couple things. Number one, we have the issue on the money or property, which certainly encompasses all of these things. And if you have one of the claims, which is legally flawed, then it doesn't matter that there are other claims or other means alleged that may have been satisfactory to uphold the conviction. And two, we have detailed in our brief in a couple places, including the argument that we make, which I think is a very serious argument, on the sufficiency of the evidence, that each of these means, there is not proof. And so you have to have, reading this record, grave doubt about whether anything was proved in terms of a criminal fraud. It's a far cry. It's one thing to say, you know what, they violated a provision of the city's regulations, and the city should take some action. They should bar them from being able to contract with the city. It's a vastly different thing to say this is a criminal, federal criminal fraud. And that was not proven in this case. I do want to, if I...
Right. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Campbell.
Thank you.
Mr. Marzi?
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. I'm Kristen Lamarzi for the United States.
What's the difference between McNally and this case?
In McNally, Your Honor, the court in McNally reversed the conviction in that case because the jury was instructed they could convict on proof that the scheme deprived the citizens of Kentucky of the right of the honest conduct of the state's business. And in reaching that conclusion, the court noted that the jury wasn't instructed to find the city actually paid more for its insurance policies, nor was it charged
Correct.
But the
so what's the difference?
The court in McNally went on to say, and this part is left out of the quotations from McNally in the brief, in Mr. Fenzel's brief, the jury was also not charged that to convict it must find the Commonwealth was deprived of control over how its money was spent, suggesting, of course, that such an instruction would have been sufficient in that case, and that such a deprivation would have been within the reach of the mail and wire fraud statutes. And, of course, here Mr. Fenzel doesn't challenge the court's instruction on the elements of fraud. The jury was charged that they had to find a scheme to defraud.
Deprived here. I mean, Urban was the low bidder and got the contract. So what's...
Well, as you noted earlier, Your Honor, the city did pay for MBE and WBE services that
That's
it never received.
That's the only thing I can understand. I don't understand the rest of the case. Forget about them. If they weren't in the picture or if Urban had given them a chunk of the contract, then what would be the problem?
I think the multiple bids that Mr. Fenzel and his co-conspirators orchestrated in this case was material. Mr. Fenzel and his partner... Mr. Fenzel and his partner knew that the city...
How is it material that there were seven bidders instead of four bidders?
The city was deceived into thinking there were multiple independent bids for this contract.
There were multiple independent bidders. There were four, not seven. I'm asking you, what difference would it make to the city if there had been only four bidders and not seven bidders?
The question is whether or not Mr. Fenzel intended to deceive.
Question. What is the difference to the city if there are four bidders or there are seven? If there had been only four, would they have said, well, four isn't enough. We want more bidders. Is that?
We don't know, Your Honor, but Mr. Fenzel knew that they had previously.
Is there evidence that if the city had had only the four bidders, of which Urban was the lowest, Urban might not have gotten the contract because the city might have said, look, four isn't enough. You know, we want to hear from other people. Is there evidence of that?
The evidence showed the
is
city...
Is there evidence? Look, you answer my question.
Is there evidence of that?
That's a yes and no question.
There is no evidence as to what the city might have done had they received four
bids. So as far as we know, as far as the jury knows, it didn't make any difference that the three that Urban had approached submitted bids. Absolutely no effect on anything.
I think the evidence showed that the city had let the contract...
Is there any evidence that their presence in the bidding had any effect on the award of the contract?
There is no way to know.
There is not. Now, I don't even see what was wrong with Urban having gone to these other bidders and said, look, we're the only people who actually do this refurbishing of these garbage pails, but, you know, we don't trust the city, it's very corrupt, and we don't think they like us, so we're facing a situation where we're not going to get the contract, we're the only people who can do the work. So you should bid, and if you get the bid, we'll sell you our assets, or we'll do the work for you, you know, and you'll get your... you'll get a profit. We'll get less of a profit than if we won the bid. What's wrong with that? I don't see that that's fraud.
That's not the evidence as to the Veronica Trucking bid.
Look,
in that
I
case, it was forged entirely.
I'm not talking about the MBE and the WB. That's the strongest part of your case. I'm interested in the rest of the case. If you take away those companies, I don't see what the fraud is.
I'm not talking about the WB and MB certification, Your Honor. I'm talking about the forged bid on behalf of Veronica Trucking. There was a bid submitted on behalf of Veronica, a bid for the entire contract.
That's the WBE. I don't want to talk about them.
Yes, Your
Honor. Supposing they weren't in the case, is there any fraud?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, maybe I'm not understanding the question.
Take away the MBE and the WBE, is there any fraud in their merely going to another company and saying, look, you bid, and then we'll give you the equipment, we'll do the work for you, but we want you to bid because we're afraid that on our bid, their hostility to us is going to make them turn us down. So here's an opportunity for you, the other company. You can bid. We'll help you do the contract, and that way we'll make some money from it because we're afraid our bid is going to be turned down. I don't see what's wrong with that.
If that were the evidence, Your Honor, I agree that then this case probably would not have been prosecuted.
Well, it is the evidence, of course.
I don't think the evidence is that Mr. Fenzel and Mr. Ritter entirely forged a bid on behalf of another company without that company's knowledge. That's not the same.
Forget about the MBE and WBE for 1 minute? Because what I've said to you, if you set that aside, if they weren't in the picture, those two little companies... Mm-hmm. Would there be any fraud?
With respect to the Roto bid, which I believe is the one you're referring to, the evidence showed not that they went and said, we're afraid to bid, please bid and use our facilities, but rather lied about their intent to also submit a bid, and so duped them into submitting that separate bid on behalf of Roto Industries by representing that Urban itself would not have submitted a bid.
You're saying Roto is a victim of the fraud along with the city?
No, I'm saying Roto was not we did not charge the case alleging Roto as a victim of the fraud, but as part of this scheme of deceit, the co-conspirators did deceive Roto into submitting that bid, forged a bid by a separate company, and then also submitted bids on behalf of Urban and their other company, Uniqued. And all of that, we think the evidence showed, established that they were trying to deceive the city into thinking there were multiple bids. The city had let the contract before.
There were multiple bids, and that's why I asked you whether if there had been only four bids, the city would have asked for more bids.
We don't know, Your Honor. The city did that in the past.
They didn't put any evidence on that.
The evidence showed.
Let me ask you about this Brown thing, which I find shocking, actually. You say in your brief on page 29, Brown had reviewed bid documents, spoken to decision makers, and seen bids rejected for failure to sign the certification. What is the phrase, seen bids rejected for failure to sign the certification, mean?
In this case, the evidence was the Uniqued bid was rejected for failure to sign the certification. Mr. Brown was the fraud investigator on this case, so he had reviewed the documents with respect to that bid.
So is this all hearsay?
It's based on his review of the documents.
All hearsay.
Yes, Your Honor.
Your evidence is all hearsay. I don't understand. Look, you have people who are spoken to decision makers. It was the decision maker that makes the decision. Why didn't they testify?
The government determined that Mr. Brown's testimony with respect to the meaning and purpose.
I'm very disturbed by your failure to call the witnesses who made the decisions, who were under your control. They made the decisions. Instead, you use a cop, basically, to give hearsay about essential evidence in the case.
In this case where the government...
This is hearsay. He's telling what people said. And he's testifying for the truth that the decision maker said that, you know, he would never have approved this contract if he... Someone said that. I doubt it, actually. But someone is alleged to have said that he would never have given this contract to Urban because of the shenanigans. And he testifies to that. And why isn't that just hearsay?
I don't think he testified that anyone told that to him.
Why do you represent that to him? You said in your brief he spoke to decision makers.
As part of his experience.
What do you mean part of his experience? He spoke to decision makers. They said something. And he repeats that to the jury, what they told him.
As part of Mr. Brown's job as a fraud investigator, he spoke to...
So look, you're saying that if cops speak to officials, because it's part of their business to speak to officials... Officials never have to testify. Just cops tell them. Cops testify what decision makers told. So you wipe out the hearsay rule without, of course, qualifying this guy as an expert. You just wipe out the hearsay rule by saying, oh, it's his personal experience.
Mr. Brown was subject to extensive cross-examination. I don't think the jury was laboring under a misapprehension of the basis of his opinion.
It's a hearsay rule, and I don't trust what Brown says about decision makers. Why did you hold back these decision makers? This is very suspicious. Are they crooks? Is that what's going on here? You don't want to expose them to a jury?
I believe that the government concluded that because proof
of
actual...
You don't want these people cross-examined as to why they are hostile to Urban. You don't want to pick up the rock and let the world see what goes on in contracting by the city of Chicago.
Senator Martin.
Yes.
During this cross-examination you speak of, Investigator Brown was asked, you were not involved in any discussions whatsoever with anybody in the procurement at the time these bids were being considered, correct? That's correct.
Correct.
So if that's accurate, he has not, has he, specifically testified that he talked to a decision maker in this case?
No, Your Honor. He, as in the course of his 7 years' experience, has obviously spoken to many decision makers about how the city uses the certification and how they do their work, and it was obviously that experience informed his perception of the evidence here. But we did not intend to imply that the jury was given an impression that he was merely parroting what he had been told about how the decision was made in this case, and there was no objection on that basis.
Just as an aside, this is not an antitrust case.
No, it is not, Your Honor.
How is it, if you can tell, inform me, how is this prosecuted by the antitrust division?
When the conduct was first referred to us, there was a suspicion that bid rigging or some other activity might be involved. After investigating, we concluded that this was more appropriately charged as fraud.
Thank you.
If the court has no further questions.
Why did you go down the road that the district judge apparently said you shouldn't go down with respect to the direct examination of Investigator Brown?
I don't believe it's a fair characterization that the judge made a ruling about what questions were inside and outside of bounds with respect to Mr. Brown. There was a colloquy at the end of the first day of questioning, and the judge essentially said, I need to hear the questions as they come, and I'll make rulings in the moment. And he did that. And, of course, with respect to these two passages that Mr. Fenzel complains of today, he admitted that testimony and post-trial concluded that the evidence was properly admitted and, in any event, any error admitting it was harmless in light of the other evidence of the materiality of the certification, including the fact that another bid had been rejected for failure to sign it, as well as the testimony of other lay witnesses about what the certification meant and how important it was to the city.
But the testimony about the other bid that was rejected for failure to sign the certification came from Brown as well, right?
As well as there was an evidence that was admitted, the letter from the city, which informed that bidder that its bid had been rejected for failure to sign the certification. I cannot recall, but I believe that may have been come in through Brown, an exhibit through him. But it was, as I say, that there was documentary evidence of that as well as Mr. Brown's testimony.
Did you or the FBI talk to the decision makers to verify Brown's impressions of how decisions are made?
I believe that, yes, the government did interview people from the procurement office. Well.
So why did you pick Brown as your witness?
I think that Mr. Brown was able to testify on a wide range of things. He investigated the fraud. He testified as to the forged documents, the extensive use of whiteout, and how the deceit was accomplished.
So he testified all those things, but why not have a witness who testifies to the actual decisions?
I can't answer that, Your Honor, except to say that
in fact,
I think the government
concluded.
You have
a witness who testified to this decision. You're saying it's your brief is vague on this, but you're saying he just testifies to general decision making policy.
He testified as to the meaning and purpose of the certification. Yes, in the course of giving his testimony.
Testify about this particular certification.
I believe the certification is not unique to this contract, but yes, he testified about the purpose of the certification. It was clear from cross-examination he wasn't involved in selecting the contractor here. Correct.
Well, but why wouldn't the person who was involved testify? Why not ask someone awarded this bid to Urban, so why not call that person and say, why did you award it to Urban, say the low bidder, And then asked, well, would you have awarded it to Urban if you had known about these various things? I mean, simplest thing in the world. Why wouldn't you have that witness? It creates a suspicion that you trust that guy. He's going to say the wrong thing. Whereas Brown didn't make the decision. He's got this just general impression of how things are done. So he testifies about generalities, not about the transaction, which he's not supposed to do because he's not an expert witness.
Well, as the district court concluded, I think his testimony was properly admitted as lay opinion.
Why didn't you have him certified as an expert, qualified as an expert? It's very badly handled.
Mrs. Marcy, Mr. Ritter pled guilty, right?
Yes, sir.
And he received a cooperation departure.
I believe that's right. Yes, Your Honor.
Is that for testimony in another case?
I don't believe he testified in any other case, Your Honor.
So was that for purposes of this case?
Well, a cooperation...
You understand. Judge Castillo said it was a glaring hole in your case and called it a close circumstantial case when he denied the motion for directed verdict. Is there a reason why he was just... judgment call that he was not an appropriate witness in this case?
I believe that's right, Your Honor. A cooperation departure might include testimony at trial or any number of other things. No, so
I'm aware of that. I just wonder what the cooperation was as far as this prosecution and the comment by the trial judge about his absence.
I believe that the trial counsel concluded that his testimony wasn't necessary in light of the other evidence, and the jury apparently agreed. I see I'm out.
That's another suspicious circumstance that he didn't testify. You concealed all the natural witnesses. Just put the investigator on. You must have thought that these other people, the people who actually knew what was going on, would undermine your case. Otherwise, you would have put them on.
You take
the remote witness who has no firsthand knowledge of this, of the reason for the contract, or what they would have done if they'd known. So he's the only person to testify, the one who doesn't, even though there are abundant witnesses who are directly involved in this and would testify about exactly what would happen. I don't get that as a prosecutor. I get it as a strategy. These other witnesses probably would have hurt your case.
Well, as the government...
The reason why you would put on the person who has no direct knowledge of the transaction.
Well, as the government did not need to prove that the city actually relied, but rather that the deceit was capable of influencing the city's decision,
But a big emphasis was made at trial, and... The closing statement said the city did rely, that the city wouldn't have let the contract if it had known what was going on. Now you're saying that's irrelevant.
I'm not saying it's irrelevant.
Irrelevant when it was in the closing argument.
I'm not saying it's irrelevant, Your Honor.
You said it was irrelevant.
I must have misspoken if I did that, Your Honor.
Reliance is unnecessary. If reliance is unnecessary, it's irrelevant that they wouldn't have given the contract.
I think that the government counsel concluded that the evidence that was submitted was sufficient to prove the elements of fraud, including materiality.
You weren't the trial counsel.
I was not the trial counsel, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Marzi.
Thank you.
Mr. Campbell, anything further?
If I may, I'll try and not take more than 60 seconds, but I want to address 3 points. One is, with respect to McNally, the court's question was, what is the difference? And the answer was, well, in McNally, the state was deprived of the power regarding how its money was spent. And that's exactly the point. This didn't deprive the city with respect to how its money was spent, because it was going to let a contract for the refurbishment of garbage carts no matter what, just like the state of Kentucky was going to buy insurance no matter what. So there is
except
no deprivation.
Some of that was
there.
Supposed to go to minority business enterprises and women business enterprises.
That's right. And this goes to my the second point I wanted to hit on quickly, which is you have to differentiate between Mr. Ritter and Mr. Fenzel in this case. You have to. The issue with respect to MBE and WBE use is, as to Mr. Fenzel, it has to be at the time the bid was submitted in January of 2005, he had no intent to use an MBE or WBE. Two things on that. One is the evidence is exactly the opposite with respect to Mr. Fenzel. The evidence is in every other contract in which he was involved with the City of Chicago, they did use an MBE and WBE as appropriate. The second is the evidence was undisputed that from the point that the contract was let all the way through the end of it, when it was terminated, it was solely Mr. Ritter, who had control over what was done, who had responsibility for the contract, for administering it, for deciding whether and when MBEs or WBEs would be used. That testimony was unequivocal and undisputed. So you have to separate between Mr. Ritter and Mr. Fenzel on that issue, which is something I know of concern to the court. But a breach of contract is not fraud, and absent evidence that Mr. Fenzel never intended to use, not that it didn't work out as time went forward when Mr. Ritter was doing this, but at the time of the bid, what's the evidence that Mr. Fenzel didn't intend to do it? The evidence is just the opposite. The evidence is he was concerned about making sure that they had an MBE and WBE, and the last on that point is Judge Castillo found, as a matter of law, that there was no sufficient evidence to prove a fraud with respect to the WBE. With respect to the WBE at all, to Veronica, he said in ruling on the post-trial motions, I agree with you. There is no sufficient evidence from which a reasonable jury could conclude that Mr. Fenzel had an intent not to use the WBE, Veronica. He said, I think it's different with respect to the MBE only because they did not actually use the MBE, Chicago Contract Cleaning, at all, whereas they did use Veronica to some extent. I would submit to you that the evidence with respect to those two entities, as it relates to Mr. Fenzel, is identical. And, in fact, the evidence about the attempted use by Mr. Ritter and his underlings of Chicago Contract Cleaning, the MBE, was they tried to use them. They went to them in the middle of the contract and said, can you sell us supplies for this contract? The woman from Chicago Contract Cleaning testified, yes, I knew. They came to me. Steve Peterson, who worked for Ritter, came to me and said, can you sell us goods on this contract, on the refurb contract? And I said, I can't. The evidence is that Urban then sent a letter to the city saying, we can't. We've tried to buy product from our designated MBE, and we can't. Can we substitute somebody? And there was no response from the city. That letter is in evidence. It's a defense exhibit. They tried to do that. So there is no evidence with respect to Mr. Fenzel. And the last point on one of the questions you asked about, well, would it make a difference if there was one bidder or four bidders or seven bidders? It's not. It's not that there is no evidence about whether that's material. The evidence is it was not material. The testimony is on page 353 of the transcript. And the evidence was, the questions were, does it matter if there's only one bidder on a contract? No, sometimes there's only one bidder, and as long as that one bidder is qualified, the contract gets awarded to that lone bidder.
Why
yes.
did they go to such trouble to submit the sham bids then, if it had no effect on the bidding process?
And the answer is, I think it is a gross misnomer to call these sham bids. It is a gross misnomer. What happened was the evidence of intent was the first thing that was read at trial. It was a stipulation between the parties. Government read it to the jury before a witness was called, and it said, here's why they did this. There was some bad press about Ritter. They were concerned that the city might not award them the contract, even if they were the lowest qualified bidder. And so they said, look, we have this big facility. We've got all the manpower and the know-how and the technology and the equipment. And if the city's not going to award the contract to us, even if we're the lowest qualified bidder, let's hope that somebody who would work with us, subcontract to us, or take over our facility, purchase the equipment and facilities, take on our manpower, let's hope someone like that gets it. And so they said to Roto, the only one that was the only third-party entity that Mr. Fenzel was involved with is Roto. He says to Roto, hey, you guys manufacture garbage carts. This might be a great business. You can get a foothold in Chicago. It looks like the city may not give us the contract, even if we're the lowest bidder. We have the facilities. We can show you how to do it. You can sublet to us or not. You ought to bid on this. That wasn't a sham bid. Rodo's testimony. The testimony was we were in it to win it. We wanted the contract. We were ready to perform on the contract. And how were they going to perform? They had said to Urban, yeah, if we get the contract, we'll take over your facility. That's not a sham bid. It just isn't.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Campbell and Ms. Lamarzi. Next case for our